Hey there, listeners. Malcolm here, sharing a couple of quick housekeeping notes as we get ready to kick off season two of the Tech Money Podcast. First, I want to make sure you're aware we have a brand new home and a brand new look online. The show now has its own dedicated website with each of the past podcast episodes and blog posts all in one place. That web address is tech-money.com. Again, that's tech-money.com. We welcome your feedback, so feel free to shoot us a note and let us know what you think. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for the Tech Money newsletter. The newsletter is also a new edition that'll be released every Friday afternoon and include our most recent blog posts, podcast episodes, and any interesting news around technology and or money that we think you'd like to. Also, a quick thank you to our super passionate audience of money nerds. In 2021, our first year of production, we reached over 20,000 downloads. Actually, in less than 10 months, but who's counting? Anyone who's ever created a podcast before knows just how big an accomplishment that is, and that couldn't have happened without your support. We also appreciate those of you who have written into the show's email inbox or messaged us via social media, and just as an FYI, the email address has changed too. You can now reach out to us with any questions, comments, or kudos via podcast@tech-money.com. Again, that's podcast@tech-money.com. We look forward to our next listener questions episode where we share some of your favorite emails with the entire listening audience. And if you haven't already, we ask that you keep sharing this show with your friends and colleagues, leave a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast listening app, and also subscribe so that new episodes will show up in your podcast feed automatically. These things will help more people discover this show and help us to expand the community of money nerds even more. Now with that, let's get into the show.
Welcome to the Tech Money Podcast, where the worlds of technology and personal finance collide. Hosted by certified financial planner, speaker, blogger, and self-proclaimed personal finance nerd, Malcolm Etheridge. Each episode aims to make you just a little bit smarter about your money, all from the perspective of the tech professional. Without further delay, here's your host.
Hey there, listeners. Malcolm here. And on today's show, we're talking startups. More specifically, we're talking about ways to fund your new business venture using the funds in your various retirement savings accounts. Starting a new business and acquiring those first few customers is hard enough, but most entrepreneurs, even those who have a killer idea and experience success right out of the gate, struggle to finance their new ventures in the early days. When a person makes the decision to start a new business, they're taking a leap of faith that their idea will catch fire and they'll see sales grow fast enough to prove the concept to themselves and to the market. However, just because you're willing to bet on yourself and take that leap of faith does not mean the banks and other traditional lenders are willing to take it with you. In most cases, they aren't. Typically, banks won't lend to businesses without an operating history of at least 2 years, and this forces entrepreneurs to pull their personal finances and put them at risk. Tapping into their personal savings, the equity in their home, maybe a personal loan, which can be very expensive. Those are all very expensive sources of capital. Maybe you liquidate your retirement savings, which also comes along with plenty of tax penalties. However, the IRS has allowed for certain carve-outs in the tax code, often referred to as Rob's plans. These plans we'll get into a little bit later on in the show. But when executed properly, there are ways for entrepreneurs to invest their retirement savings into a new business venture without incurring taxes, early withdrawal penalties, or loan costs. These transactions can be extremely complicated to execute, which is why it's imperative to work with an experienced and competent provider, as well as an attorney familiar with these types of transactions. And since I've never spent a day in anyone's law school class, let alone pass the bar in any state, I thought I better call up someone I know who has for this particular subject. Dahl Link is both an ERISA attorney, well-versed in the intricacies of these types of plans, and she's also a partner at the Washington, D.C.-based law firm, KLB Law Group. Prior to joining, she worked for a number of firms here in D.C. and out on the West Coast after she received her J.D. from Stanford Law School. So, needless to say, she's very well-versed in the ways these plans work. With that brief introduction, welcome Dahl Link to the Tech Money Podcast.
Thank you, Malcolm. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, I appreciate you agreeing to do this. This should be fun. So to get us kicked off here, I breezed through your resume pretty quickly there in my intro. What should I have included?
The name of the firm, we've changed our name to KLB Benefits Law Group. So the full name.
Did I butcher that one?
Well, you said KLB Law Group. It's sorry KLB about that Benefits one. Law Group. That's okay. It's a new name. We've only
yeah. No, get me straight. Get me straight. It definitely matters. People googling me the entire sure. the entire name.
Yeah, we're a boutique ERISA firm based in Washington D.C. We also have an attorney in California, and we work in ERISA. We advise on all sorts of types of plans, including these ROBS plans.
So you guys still have an attorney out on the West Coast, and I mentioned that you went to Stanford for law school. So mm-hmm. what in the world are you doing back here in D.C. when you had that beautiful weather out there on the West Coast and you traded it for not only cold, but also humidity?
I'm originally from the East Coast. I'm from Philadelphia, and I went mm-hmm. to UVA undergrad. And I prefer it. I prefer the East Coast, honestly. I do. Stanford's gorgeous. It's a beautiful location.
Sure.
But I love D.C. I love big cities. After Stanford, I was living in a small town in California, and I prefer cities. So it's actually my husband's job that brought us back this direction, but I'm happy to be here.
I see. Blame him.
Yeah, yeah. It's great, though. And it's also cool to live in different places, you know. So I've enjoyed the variety of different places.
I get mm-hmm. it. I've had people tell me, I don't believe that it's true, but I've had people tell me that like grew up, born, raised, lived their entire lives in places like Pasadena, mm-hmm. the Bay Area, where the weather is pretty consistently, you know, 75 degrees and sunny most of the days of the year. And I'm always like, why would you trade that in for this nonsense? And every time people are like, well, you know, I wanted to live somewhere different, and I also wanted to experience the different seasons rather than have it be the same all the time. And I'm like, that is utter nonsense as a person who grew up here. That makes, but I understand. I can understand conceptually. I don't understand like in my heart.
Well, I missed the seasons, I tell you. I did. I missed the change of seasons. And California is beautiful, but it was a little bit like being stuck on vacation. You know, I was happy to come back.
What a problem.
Right, I know.
Anyway, well, to get us kicked off here, you know, for most people listening, you mentioned that you guys are ERISA attorneys, and that's a very specific, very specialized type of work. You know, the extent of most people's knowledge around ERISA is maybe that they know that they make the rules that govern what they can and can't do inside of their company's 401k plan or some other similar, you know, company sponsored plan. Maybe. But many are not familiar with the agency and its rulemaking ability. So why don't you just explain for our listeners just what types of cases or transactions an ERISA attorney works on day in and day out?
Well, we advise the employers that sponsor the plans, the retirement plans and the medical insurance plans and mm-hmm. other kinds of benefit plans. If it's a plan and governed by ERISA, which is most benefits, then there's two government agencies primarily that supervise or deal with the compliance of these plans, and that's the Department of Labor mm-hmm. and the Internal Revenue Service. And the Department of Labor focuses on the employees being treated fairly by the plan, and the IRS focuses on the tax qualification rules to get the tax benefits, which, as most people are aware, the main tax benefit of retirement plans and other benefit plans is that there is no tax on those savings for retirement. There is no tax on the savings while they're contributed and growing in investment and as investments. But and there's only tax under when the funds are used mm-hmm. In retirement. So that those beautiful benefits come with. The tax benefits come with lots of strings attached. So,
oh, of course,
the employers are in charge of that compliance. The ordinary employees who are just participating in the plans don't really have to worry about too much. They have to, you know, they don't have too many rules to follow. It's the employers sponsoring the plans that have a lot to do to. You know, cover, make sure that their employees are covered properly and everything.
And it feels like a lot to do for them, I can say, from the work that my firm has done with the corporate plans that we manage. I have seen where You know, it's the last thing inside the company that, you know, most anybody wants to have to be dealing with. But it's also the biggest, like, hot potato that everybody's deathly afraid of getting an ERISA notice.
And it can be like a time bomb, if you know, like a time bomb hot potato. Also, I didn't really answer your question. What we do all day is clients, companies engage us to defend them to the IRS when there's an examination of the plan, or to the Department of Labor if there's an investigation. And that happens with some frequency. And then also the people become aware of, on their own, employers will become aware of problems with their plans, compliance, and will help them correct failures so that they can restore the plan to compliance. Because what's sort of hanging in the balance is all those tax benefits can disappear from the date that a failure occurs until it's corrected.
You're using the words compliance and failure, which are attorney words. And so I want to specifically ask the question real quick. As far as that's concerned, I imagine you're the team that I call when I, as a business owner or one of the super highly compensated people who work for the company, get one of those notices that I have over contributed to my plan for the year based on what the rules will allow, based on the testing and all that stuff that has to happen in those kind of things.
Sure. Right? That's an excellent example of a failure that occurs. That's called an operational failure. It's just a mistake, an excess amount being contributed. And that can be, those are common. It's expected that these sorts of things will happen. It's easy to correct them. If you don't correct a failure, however, then your tax qualification's in jeopardy, and you could lose your tax benefits. So the compliance just means following the rules, and a failure is a mistake that's not corrected. And once it's corrected, then you're good to go into the future. And it keeps us very busy because there are a lot of rules in the plan, as you know, Malcolm. There are a lot of rules to follow.
Awesome. Well, let's transition for a second to the sort of the meat of the conversation that I teed up initially, where, you know, I am a founder of a startup. I'm looking to get my hands on some cash to be able to bring this idea to fruition. Banks have laughed me out of the room or off their website, because I guess you can just apply, you know, on your computer at this point. Or I've, you know, tried to pitch angel investors or various different venture capital investors on my idea. Nobody's really seeing it, or they're telling me, go prove the concept first, right? Get to your minimum viable product and then come talk to us after. You're just too early, right? Is kind of the common refrain that people tend to get. And so I decide, you know what? I'm just going to take the $200, $500 million, whatever it is that I've saved into my 401k plan. I'm going to cash that bad boy out, and I'm going to use that money to start this company. And I can already see the steam coming out of your ears as I say that, because you know that there is a better way to do this, using the same pool of funds, but not selling everything in there, liquidating the account and paying that giant IRS tax bill on day one to get access to your own money. So let's get into that for a second. Can you describe how a company retirement plan like a 401k can be used to finance that startup idea?
Yes. What the basic outline of this Rob's funding technique is to establish a C corporation that will be the startup, and that corporation sponsors, adopts, establishes a new retirement plan, and it's a retirement plan that permits the participants to direct their own investments, and then the employees of that company, which is probably at least this one person who's the dreamer, the startup founder, that person needs to be an operating company in as opposed to an investment company. And the employee, or maybe there's two or three employees who are interested in doing this, they are hired by the company as W-2 employees. Mm-hmm. And they, as eligible employees, under the terms of this plan that the company has adopted, these people can choose to roll funds into their new plan accounts from some other place, which is a prior employer's retirement plan or an IRA. It must be a traditional IRA. This doesn't work for Roth IRAs. But if you if these new employees of the startup roll funds into their new plan accounts, they can use those funds. They may direct the plan to invest those funds in employer securities. And employer securities are the stock of the corporation itself. So you're telling your plan that's sponsored by your company, hey, I want to invest in the company. Mm-hmm. And the plan does that. And that particular type of stock is just common stock, but it's called, for the plan purposes, it's called qualifying employer securities. And the qualifying employer securities, which I call QES for short, or everybody calls QES for short, those securities are highly regulated. And ordinarily, any investment or any transaction between a retirement plan and its company that's sponsoring it would be a prohibited transaction. That's forbidden under the code. But the qualifying employer securities meet an exception under this prohibited transaction rules. That's found in ERISA at section 408E of ERISA, and some related sections and regulations that permit the retirement plan to invest in the employer securities. So there's a few very strict minimum requirements for this. Mm-hmm. The company that's sponsoring the plan must be a C corporation, so it cannot be an LLC, or it can't take the S election. Mm-hmm. It must be, nor can it be a sole proprietorship. It needs to be a C corporation, and it needs to be an operating company, an investment company. It can't be just, you know, it has to be producing goods or services.
I'm not going to set this up to go buy rental real estate, basically.
Correct. Yeah. And just as a side note, if you do want to do a passive investment in something where you're not going to work in the company, or so it's someone else's company, you're not going to work in it. Investor, you can do that with your self-directed IRA. Sure. You can talk to your IRA custodian about that. But if you yourself are going to work for the company, or and it needs to be an operating company, then yeah, it's not for passive investments exactly. And yeah, then,
the way I understand this, just to put a button on that, is you as the owner, as soon as you complete this transaction, get the funds out of your 401k and into the new company's plan, you're immediately filing an amendment that basically says nobody else can do this, right? So that takes away the ability of that investor that you're talking about, who would try and come along later on and say, I'm going to do this same transaction.
You mean for this is only going to be offered to people who are eligible for the plan to begin with, or eligible
to participate? Which is basically
employees. Right? Yeah, employees of the company. Now, if the Rob's investor or small group of investors who are starting the company with the Rob's plan, they usually offer the plan to any employees that are employed at the time. So usually in a startup, there isn't anybody else but the founders. So that it just works out. While that offer is open, while that option is available in the plan, then yeah, no one else is going to be able to take advantage of it. But if there were other folks in the company, they would get a notice that says you have the option to buy these qualifying employer securities also, because other people in the plan have done it. We're mm-hmm. making you aware that it's an option that's required under ERISA. You can't treat employees unfairly. You know, you can't keep it just available to a select few. But those rank and file employees, those ordinary people who may or may not even have money to invest in the company are well advised to avoid this kind of investment. It's very risky, and they would be minority shareholders. There's a lot that goes into that decision, and they would be very, very unlikely to make that decision. I've never seen that happen.
Well, let me back this train up for a second. We got super technical super fast, and so I want to make sure that I sort of unpack a lot of what you just gave me, because there was a lot of good information in there, and I want to make sure that anybody listening to this who needs the information didn't miss different bits and pieces of it. So one thing I want to get clear really quickly, if I go to the Rob's route, am I required to pay the age 59 and a half early withdrawal penalty or ordinary income tax the way I would with a regular distribution?
No. No, this is all within the scope of a qualified rollover, either from your IRA or your former employer plan. that is remains tax deferred. So there's, okay. there's no.
So because I'm going one tax deferred vehicle 401k to the new tax deferred vehicle 401k, I'm allowed to avoid paying any income taxes or early withdrawal excise tax on that because it's still a tax deferred to tax deferred transaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. So you would just, the 1099R that shows that rollover, that your tax reporting would code that as a non-taxed event.
Okay. The reason I wanted to make sure that I got that clear and on the record is because I teed this up by saying it's a better alternative for folks who normally would be wanting to use retirement funds as sort of a last resort to get their hands on the funding to start the company. Yeah. It keeps you from doing that is where I wanted to go with that. But then another thing, as you're talking, I'm thinking about this, like, I don't want to come off as a wet blanket here, but I can't help but think about how many small businesses don't make it beyond year three, right? And then I think about how hard it is to make up ground in your retirement savings once you take a big distribution from your 401k or IRA like this. Would you consider this the same way that I've been teeing it up as a last resort source of funding for a business, or am I thinking about this wrong?
Yes and no. I think of this as sort of a yes, it is a last resort unless there are certain circumstances. And it, for example, for a person who's starting up a business for whom this is not their first startup, who has experience and therefore a little bit more likelihood of success, it's not as risky because there's a lower chance that they'll fail. And also there's, I think I have seen this succeed handily in situations where the investor is using the retirement funds as their part of the financial package that's approved by an SBA loan. So when you get an SBA loan, you have to cough up some money of your own, and these ROBS funds.
Yeah, they want skin.
Yeah, and the ROBS funds can be that investment, that personal contribution to the financing. And the reason that the SBA, I mean, I'm not saying that it's a hand, you know, that therefore there's no risk. Of course, you're still risking your retirement savings. Yeah. But the fact that there's a bank, using the SBA program that's approving it gives a third party that's sort of vetting the whole venture. That gives me comfort that at least somebody, that it's not just wishful thinking on the ROBS owner's part, it's the startup person's part. It's actually been blessed by the whole venture's been approved by a lender. That's gives sort of as a kind of security, I suppose, or reassurance. But it's and also it well one good thing about it from a personal standpoint, I know it is a huge risk, but it's also true that you're not that because the business entity exists. This is not a sole proprietorship. It's not attached to your personal assets because it's a separate entity taking the risk of loss. You have a protection against personal bankruptcy there. You can lose your retirement savings, but you're not going into personal debt. Your home isn't on the line, so you have this sort of floor where, okay, so it's a calculated risk and it should be taken very, very cautiously. But at least you won't be going into debt, with running up credit cards, for example, like to fund your dream, so to speak.
I think that's a good counterpoint to what I just kind of laid out as my concern, where normally the SBA would tell you, we need you to take out a mortgage against the equity in your house, sort of as their backstop, right? If you don't have the cash available to make this happen, you don't want to tap into your retirement savings, or you don't have any to make this happen, we need you to tap into the equity in your home and put a second mortgage against that property to get that skin in the game so that we know you're serious and you're really in this for the long haul. And I always just feel like even if you took, a less than favorable loan from a bank or some other sort of traditional lender, it could be a bit of a drag on revenue to pay it back initially, yes. right? But at least if your business went under, you'd still have your retirement savings left. But I wasn't thinking about that through the context of the SBA prefers to see me put skin in the game. And the last thing I want to do is compromise the roof over my head. I'd rather it be investment savings, even if they are earmarked for retirement. So maybe you just gave me a different way to think about how this transaction could be valued.
Yeah, I mean, but one sort of note that you alluded to earlier about not being able to make up lost retirement savings is that in most of the Rob's owners that I've met, and I've done hundreds of Rob's transactions, most of them do this in their 40s. When they've got enough in their retirement mm-hmm. savings mm-hmm. to make a different, to make a meaningful contribution, for example, to buy a franchise or something, it's enough that they've saved enough, and but they're close to retire, they're closer to retirement, So by the time closer than a 20 something, for example, so by the time they're in the middle of life with all those demands on your finances, kids in school sure. and such, so it's a little bit scary, they're closer to needing that retirement money when they're just at the point when they're thinking about risking it. So it is, again, it's something to be undertaken very, very cautiously. Absolutely.
Yeah, there is no startup without mm-hmm, risk, right? You're essentially jumping yeah. off a cliff and stitching together your parachute at the same time.
Yes.
So I completely understand.
Yes. Speaking as a business owner myself, I could not agree more.
Yes. Yeah. So answer this one for me. Does it have to be a startup, or can I use this option to give myself a capital infusion into an already existing business?
You can use it in the middle of the life of the company, after it's been established. There's no rule that says that that these shares have to be newly issued or what's the word, new, for a startup. Mm-hmm. I call that a midstream Rob's, so you're going along and you need the capital infusion. And in fact, some Rob's owners start out with a Rob's in the beginning and then tap into it again, later. They do another Rob's transaction. So you can do a series of Rob's transactions. And there's just a bunch of rules associated with it. The details are important to avoid falling afoul of the tax rules here. But it's it can work, and you just have to be sensitive to the fact that you're offering, the plan has to be amended to permit it. It must be a C corporation, so you can change the entity type. People have done that. Mm-hmm. You'd have to change the entity type if it's not a C corporation. And we've had people recently I did a transaction for a person who bought out her employer by using a Rob's funding,
that
which is very exciting. It was
that's a full circle.
Yeah, well, it was a $9 million deal, and her retirement savings represented about $1 million of it. So it was very, mm-hmm. that's a very exciting, non-startup version of using Rob's. And
talk about betting.
Yes,
yourself.
Yes. And so it was very, very exciting, because doing an acquisition or merger with a new company is always exciting from a benefits point of view anyway. That was a thrilling transaction.
To that point, I have been told that these types of plans are perfect for someone wanting to purchase a franchise. Mm-hmm. Why is that?
I think it's because the franchisers know it exists and they discuss it a lot. The franchise, mm-hmm. Sellers. It's true. I mean, why not? You can do it with a franchise. And the other thing is that the amount of money available is sort of a nice fit for a franchise, because most franchises, whatever they run, I'm not even sure. I've worked with many, many franchisees, but I say they mm-hmm. run between, $50,000 and $150,000, right? To buy sure. into the franchise, to buy the single franchise, that fits within most people's retirement savings that they've got at the time. What's the word? They're ready to invest in a new company.
There are.
And franchises are less likely to fail than Anon franchise, mm-hmm. I think. So, you know, there's, although that's just, that's not always true. You know, I've also helped franchises go through the very painful process of unwinding a Rob's due to failure. You know, you can unwind a Rob's at any time, but when you have to do it because the company's going under, it's very, very painful.
Yeah. So not specifically anything in the code that makes it more attractive for them. It's just, that's the place that I'm going to the conferences. I'm going to the different meetings. My CPA is more familiar with it, all those kind of things. And so that's just the group that's gravitated more toward than anybody else.
Yes. It seems to have been, it's okay. Part of the market there. They like to promote this idea.
So you mentioned earlier on that the only business, or not the only, one of the businesses that's prohibited from this type of transaction is if you're going to use it for passive investing firms. Are there any other businesses that are excluded from using Rob's funds?
No. Any lawful business that's an operating company, that's a C corporation.
You said any lawful business, so I'm going to assume that kicks out any
of the Oh, well, you can, no, you can actually, yeah, I mean, that's entities. Becoming such a gray area now, isn't it? Yeah, there are lawyers that specialize in startups for the cannabis industry, we call it. but I'm not one of them, but you can do anything, any business at all. It has to just follow those various rules.
On that note, though, what are some of the more interesting businesses you've seen folks start using their retirement funds?
Oh, real everything under the sun. Every kind of franchise, you know, burger joints, Jimmy John's, dry cleaners. There's a plastic surgery clinic I've had experience with.
That's interesting.
A large advertising agency. All kinds of different services. Oh, and I suppose, you know, I apologize. I remembered now, in response to your last question about what companies are not allowed to be funded in this way, I believe that the state laws governing law firms in particular, and maybe some doctors' practices, will not permit these entities to be C corporations, or there's sometimes there's an interference with what type of entity can or cannot be a C corporation, and that can cause problems with you know, that can prevent you from using a Rob's to start it. So that depends on state law. But in any case, you just, for most businesses that do Rob's, I mean, they're the ones, you know, we've had clothing factories, all kinds of different businesses, yoga studios, Dunkin' Donuts, you know, all the franchises you can think of. We've had people use these Rob's plans to fund all those kinds of things, including non-franchise ones too.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So I'm going to go back real quick to another one of your, where I said we got into the weeds and started getting technical, a couple different terms you were using, prohibited transactions and self-dealing. And the reason those kind of perked my ears up are because, you know, in 2021, there was quite a bit of hubbub, if you will, regarding folks who had figured out, I'm saying folks in air quotes, people will know specifically who I'm referring to, but folks who had figured out ways to get shares of their founder stock into their retirement accounts once upon a time. And, you know, now we're talking, you know, multi-million and billion-dollar IRA balances in some cases. And the IRS has come out even stronger than before now in taking a hard line against quote-unquote prohibited transactions and quote-unquote self-dealing. And so can you just explain what those terms mean and how they can actually occur?
Yeah. In the context of these plans, the employer-sponsored retirement plans, which is what these Rob's plans are, you know, and this is a big universe, right? These are for all 401k plans, all profit-sharing plans. These are all employer-sponsored retirement plans. So this is distinct from the IRAs. The IRAs all have their own set of rules and problems, and that's there too. But for the Rob's plans, and all retirement plans that are sponsored by a company, the prohibited transactions require careful. You just have to follow the rules not to do business between have transactions occurring between the plan and the company that's sponsoring the plan, or between the plan and anyone in control of the company. So, for example, the plan couldn't decide that it needed to hire somebody to work for the plan directly who was involved with the company, you know, like a director of the company or a spouse of the director of a company. It couldn't hire the registered investment advisor who's advising the plan on plan investments. It couldn't hire that person from a company that's owned by a director of the company or a relative of a director, that kind of thing. So all those sort of cozy deals, I guess, where it just sounds like, gosh, that person got this money from the plan doing legitimate business, right, for the plan, like whatever it may be. But they got that job because they know somebody in the company who's sponsoring the plan. Like that's not cool. And it is a prohibited transaction. And even the things I do a lot of prohibited transaction work for IRA investors as well as for these retirement plans that are sponsored by companies. And the whole universe of PT the prohibited transaction law can be navigated. You can organize things properly so that you don't commit a prohibited transaction. But with the company-sponsored retirement plans, there's another layer that people often don't think about. That's that you're not allowed, even if you can get around the technical prohibited transaction rules, you can still commit a fiduciary violation by not keeping the plan foremost in conflict of interest. So it's not you need to, what's the word? You need to preserve the assets of the plan solely for the benefit of the plan participants. Right. So you're not allowed to, even if you can find some way to get around the sort of black letter rules of the prohibited transaction parts of the code, you're not allowed to do something that's preferring or leaning towards something that could maybe become a prohibited transaction, I guess. That's the best way to describe it, is you can't come near doing a prohibited transaction either. And that's a gray area. It's very important for Rob's plans and for all retirement plans to remember the fiduciary rules and that exclusive benefit rule I just mentioned, that you have to keep the plan participants first in your priorities.
So I know that this work tends to be pretty subjective, so I'm not going to ask you to give us any sort of quote live here on the air, right? There's no gotcha here. Mm-hmm. But what does it typically cost in your estimation to establish a Rob's plan, right? Said another way, do I need to be already rich, or is it something most people can reasonably afford to tap into?
I believe that you don't need to be wealthy to do a Rob's transaction. I mean, obviously the money that's used to finance the company is a lot of money by most people's mm-hmm. standards, you know, a couple $100,000, $500,000, $1 million, whatever it may be. That amount is what it is, right? But the expense of establishing the Rob's, the transaction costs, doesn't have to be very high. Most of the big Rob's promoters that are out there will charge about $5,000 for the service of setting up the plan. If you did it through a business consultant or a third-party administrator that's not a Rob's promoter, you could do it a little bit more cheaply, certainly cheaper than $5,000. I think that's on the high end, the $5,000. And I myself, I very rarely do Rob's plans. Our law firm doesn't, we don't sponsor plans. We don't write the plan documents. We don't, you know, we would refer somebody to a plan provider anyway, but I wouldn't bother referring somebody to a promoter. I'd refer them to a good third-party administrator that knows Rob's plans. Then there are a couple that are very good.
Right. And you guys are sort of seated in the middle, helping me stay on the right side of right as we're creating that plan document.
Exactly. Yeah. Because a good third-party administrator that would help establish the plan and sell the plan document, for example, to the company, that good third-party administrator will not try to practice law. They'll they'll tell somebody, you need an attorney to do the corporate side of things. You need an attorney to advise you on the plan, the prohibited transaction rules and the plan related stuff. But there, you know, that, and that's great. You know, you don't, there's no particular reason that an attorney has to get involved initially. But it's probably a good idea, at least for a little bit of advice. You know, I, as always, this is my plug for lawyers in general, is that the lawyer is looking out, you pay the lawyer to look out for you. Their job, like my job, is to look out for your interests. Whereas all the other service providers are providing a service, but they're looking out for their interests. They're protecting their rear ends. They know how to do that. And they don't need to protect your interests. They provide you a service. It's a contractual arrangement, and that's that. But the lawyer is looking out for you. So there's, and you know, I know lots about Rob's things that a new company founder won't know, so I can help find, sort of look for the pitfalls, avoid the pitfalls.
Well, awesome. That's good stuff. Well, thanks, Dahl. This was great. Where can people find you if they want to learn more about you and or your firm after this goes live?
Our website is www.erisadc.com. That's E-R-I-S-A-D-C.com. And I happen to have a blog on our website that includes a series of Rob's posts that will be growing. The site's only been added this blog recently, but we're going to be including Rob's topics on that because I'm very much interested in compliance and helping Rob's owners stay on the straight and narrow so their companies can succeed.
Sure. Well, with that, Eric with an A, why don't you go ahead and close us out, sir?
All right. Thank you, Malcolm. And thank you, Dahl, so much for being here. In the interest of full disclosure, we think it's important to let the listening audience know that Dahl Lank is also a client of the financial planning firm where Malcolm works. However, she is not being compensated for doing this interview, nor should her presence be construed as an endorsement of Malcolm or his firm. Next, and lastly, we want to thank you so much for tuning in and listening to the Tech Money Podcast with Malcolm Etheridge. If you have not subscribed to the podcast yet, please click the subscribe now button below. This way, when Malcolm comes out with a new podcast, it'll show up directly on your listening device. We humbly ask that you share this podcast and leave a review, as this will help others find the show. You can connect with Malcolm on social at Malcolm on Money. We'd love to hear from you and answer any questions you have, and you can do so by emailing them to podcast@techmoney.com. Thanks again for listening today. For everyone at Tech Money, our hope is that this show helped make you a little smarter about your money.
This has been the Tech Money Podcast. For more information on today's topic, to review the show notes, or to catch up on past episodes, be sure to check out malcolmetheridge.com/podcast. And if you have an idea for a show topic that you'd like us to cover, or you want to send us feedback, the web address again is malcolmetheridge.com. You can also find Malcolm across all social media platforms at Malcolm on Money. This episode was written and created by Malcolm Etheridge, with the production, the editing, and sound controls powered by Proudmouth. This has been a Malcolm on Money original. Thank you for listening. The information shared in this recording and by its guests represents the views and opinions of the guests and does not represent the views or opinions of the host. This content has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. This content is not, nor is it intended to be a substitute for professional financial advice. It is always recommended that you seek the advice of your financial advisor or other qualified financial service provider with any questions you may have regarding your personal financial situation.